This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Yeah. Clear enough for you?
All right.
If I'm Sheriff Joe Arpaio, you know, the president's going to pardon me. You know, even if I plead guilty, you know, the justice system is going to say, you know what, Michael Flynn, yeah, you know what, you're not guilty. I know you said you were. I know you lied. I know we convicted you. Now, think of that versus how long it took the Central Park Five to get their names expunged from what they hadn't done. And they never pled guilty.
This has been a difficult stretch for the country, with millions sick, out of work, or simply stuck at home. But the horrific murder of George Floyd shifted our collective focus to a very different sort of epidemic. Mr. Floyd joined the names of Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, Breonna Taylor, and thousands of other African Americans who've been killed by the police in this country. We often hear that at times like this we need to have a national conversation about race. But where do we start? I decided to start with a personal conversation with a longtime friend of mine to get his insights into what it feels like to grow up black in America and to better understand the work that needs to be done on the racial justice front. This week on Sea Change Radio, in the first of two conversations about race, we welcome Maurice Plains, a high school friend of mine who works for the Emerging Scholars Program in the DC metro area. We discuss racism and police brutality in America, his own reaction to George Floyd's murder, and the work of his organization to broaden educational opportunity for students of color.
It's hard to imagine, picture me rolling.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my good friend Maurice Plains. He is the Director of Scholars Advancement for Emerging Scholars, and he lives in the DC metro area. Maurice, it's a pleasure to have you on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here, sir.
So why don't you tell our listeners around the country what Emerging Scholars, what this organization is about, and what's the mission of the organization?
Well, to put it succinctly, our mission is to target high-performing, modest-income, grade 4 students, and then we prepare them and matriculate them and track them into the independent schools that they will attend and thereafter into college.
And maybe give some examples of some of your students in terms of their outcomes from fourth grade to, you've been in this many years. Give us an idea of the arc of some of these engagements.
So the organization has been, we're going into our 18th year. We've just admitted our 17th cohort. It's a 14-month wraparound program. So it'll start, like I said, you'll enter grade 5. Between the summer of grade 5 and 6, you'll enter our program and you'll stay with us through 24 Saturdays of the school year. And then you'll do one additional summer. So that's the 14 months there. And then we will make certain that you are have everything that you need to, like I said, apply to and matriculate into an independent school. And while we've been doing this for 18 years, I've only been with the program for the last 8. But we have many success stories. You know, we can go with a scholar who started at a small independent school in Alexandria, graduated from West Point years later, and now is a specialist in the Army with a command underneath her of more than 200 individuals. And so we're very proud of Summer Thomas. We've had a number of scholars who've gone on to play lacrosse, you know, is a favorite one of my sports, but I'll go with Anthony Diallo, who attended an independent school and became captain of his lacrosse team in his 11th grade year, remained captain in his 12th grade year, and that was the year that they won that championship for that league. Right now, he's in a pre-veterinary school at the University of Maryland in Baltimore, and he's doing rather well there and is also playing lacrosse there, too. So a third story, and it's how you define success. We had one individual who tested so very well and was on his way to an independent school to enter in grade 6, except that the financing didn't come through for him. His mother had just transferred into a new job, gave her a different type of income, and it just was too hard for them to do at that point. He went on to public school and would return back to our program to apply for grade 8. in which he did the same, got into an independent school. They wanted more money than the mom could actually sort of, you know, give at that point. So he ended up back at his public school. It turns out he graduated in the top 5% of students in the state, you know, top 1% in the school, in his actual school. And Anthony Scaff graduated UVA in 3 years instead of four because his parents could only afford to send him for those 3 years. So that's the type of scholar we have at our program.
Let's take a snapshot of where we are right now as a country. And you as an African-American man has seen since, it seems like every 5 to 10 years we have one of these shots across the bow. But this killing of George Floyd, maybe it's that we have such an uncaring president, but this seems to be different, doesn't it? Maybe you can kind of take us through your emotions, if you can, when you see something like that.
So I can answer this in several ways. What I like to do with my parents is I say to them, I'll answer as a professional, I'll answer as a parent, and then I'll answer on a personal level. Professionally, if I'm being honest, this is not surprising to see something like that. And when I have to speak to my scholars, if it does come up, you know, what I say to them is that the way that police handle, you know, African-Americans seemingly is, I guess the best words to use is, you know, without care. It doesn't seem like they're very careful with us. But the fact of the matter is that that is not something that I see changing. Even within the protests in and of themselves, you could see that if you're a hammer, then you treat everything like a nail. And maybe we're hoping that we can get a softer side of the police so that they don't have to, you know, hammer everything that's in front of them. So that's how I sort of say that in terms of the professional. In terms of being a parent, I'm a parent of a 25-year-old, also African-American male, who I have had, you know, everyone calls or says about the talk, but that's not a talk that happens once. That's a talk that happens every day that I'm with him. My son has been present with me when I've been pulled over by the police and harassed, you know, for no reason whatsoever. And there was one point, if I'm going to be honest, that I was pulled over by a police officer and he told me that I was the worst type of parent because of the music I was playing for my son at the time. I was really aghast because it says clearly on the front of it that there's a parental advisory. And I feel that if my son is going to listen to music like, you know, we were listening to, that it helps to me for me to be present there and sort of explain some of the nuances to it. But I didn't get to have that conversation on the side of the street. I was told and made to apologize to that police officer for behaving in such a fashion. I didn't really get to say to him how I really felt until we were in front of a judge and I was trying to argue my point to what I felt would be a more level-headed mind. So that would be as a parent. You know, if the definition of arrest is to stop, like you have cardiac arrest, you know, I've had at least 17 engagements where, you know, I've been stopped with the police. There's several times that I've had handcuffs placed on me. There's a number of times I've ended up behind bars. And there was one time where I ended up with a knee on my back. So this is just, you know, an experience that is day to day. You know, you and I were able to attend the same high school. And I had some encounters in that little town as well with the police, with people that you know. One of the famous stories that goes through, you know, the lore of where we attend is that there was a young student who was accosted by a police officer and had his lacrosse stick taken from him while he was walking through town under the guise of him being disturbing the peace, if you will. And that was me. That happened to myself and Kendall Price, you know, Kendall. And, you know, it was the kind of thing that when it happened, he and I sort of shook it off like, you know, this happens all the time, you know. So what I guess I want your audience to understand is that when we see the video of a George Floyd, the surprising piece is that now we get to say, see, I told you. All right. And I don't think that's the first video. You know, we saw the Eric Garner video. We've seen a number of instances where you can't turn your head away and say that this is, you know, not maltreatment. But when you see that video, what I think is very poignant about the video is that there's a nonchalance about the police officers and what they're doing. It doesn't look like they're doing anything out of character for what would be their character. It was not even something that, you know, gave that officer concern. What I think is also telling is that you had a number of people who did look on and go, oh my God, this is so unjust, and pulled up their cell phones and started to record, because in their eyes, what they were seeing was so, like I said, unjust and just out of the ordinary. But what I really think is the point that I bring home is that the story is that he had some other health issues, which, you know, caused the arrhythmia that he suffered. And that might be the case. But if he doesn't die in that situation, life goes on as normal. All right. And I think that that's one of the pieces that brings it home, is that you're watching a slow murder take place, and the utter nonchalance, the utter, you know, the method of how we do business is very glaring on that tape. This does not look like a one-off. This does not look like something that is not a process they don't do every single day. And again, I imagine that, you know, when I'm seeing that video, that George Floyd had, you know, maybe did the Rodney King, had been speeding down a highway at 120 miles an hour, high on drugs, and was a danger to himself and others. To find out that, you know, the $20 bill that he was using might have not been legitimate, or, you know, let's say it was completely counterfeit, you know, for him to be treated in the manner where you don't see any resistance, but still the full tactical approach to subduing, you know, and maintaining his position is what they do as a normal arrest. So that, I think, is what the United States and people abroad have seen as, wow, this really is something that we cannot ignore. This is something that police officers do so often and so frequently that they're not even concerned at the optics. Right? They didn't even get concerned that the video cameras came out. All you see is this officer conducting business as usual. And I think that becomes the big scary part of what we're watching.
And now it's a winter. Winter in America. And all of the healers done been killed, sent away. Yeah, the people know, the people know it's winter. Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting cause.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Maurice Plains. He's the director of Scholars Advancement for emerging scholars in the DC metro area. So Maurice, has your perspective changed over the last 40-something years, or do you still view police in the same light?
I absolutely still view police in the same light. And I have to be able to say this out loud too. All right. I know not all police officers behave in this way. All right. I know that I've encountered just as many times with police where it has gone, you know, in my favor. I know that when I had my motorcycle stolen, I called the police. So I don't want you to think that there's this sort of adversarial hate relationship with police, but I will let you know that if you are a bad policeman, you can do a lot more damage than if you're a bad doctor, all right? Than if you're a bad lawyer, if you're a bad plumber or a bad electrician, all right?
And it's also worth noting, I remember hearing somebody say when it came to the George Floyd killing, it's you can say, oh, it's just one bad cop, but when you have one bad cop acting terribly and let's say nine other cops not doing anything, you have 10 bad cops.
Correct. And what I think since, you know, since we've seen this is that what we found out is that two of those police officers were very new to the force. So they're getting, you know, basically the same sort of manual handed down to them. You know, one of them was on the job for 4 days and he's being taught that this is how we conduct business here, you know, and, another good friend of ours lives in that area. I don't know if you know that, but we have a friend that lives in St. Paul. You know, what I thought was unique is that one time when I visited in St. Paul and I'd been looking through a little bit of their history there, it turns out that in terms of crime, that Kendall lives in that area, that county of St. Paul, has the least amount of crime in the state, but they sit back to back to the county that has the most amount of crime in the country. And I was like, that is a separation of have and have nots right there. And what ends up being qualified as a crime, you know, starts with, you know, the accusation and the arrest. And sometimes the accusation is not there. It's just a police, police officer happened up to a scene and criminalized whatever was going on there. And a lot of the brothers and sisters in Minnesota say that that's exactly what happens. You know, Philando Castile was in that same area too, when he was shot as a law-abiding gun owner. Right. So when I say these things to you, I don't want you to think that we feel that everyone who sets out to be a police officer is inherently bad. In fact, I think it's the opposite, that when you set out to be a police officer, you want to do good in the community. I'm given a gun and a badge, and I'm going to solve the problems with these two instruments, regardless of the problem. And I think that that's the set of tools that we've given police officers so that they don't have other resources that could de-escalate or make this not a situation that ends up on the 6 o'clock news. So I really believe that wholeheartedly, that we need to give more tools to police officers because they are doing a very trying job, thankless in many cases. But the fact of the matter is that there are those who, let's say, started out as a great police officer and over the time, you know, have become to be jaded on the experience. You know, I understand, respect, and appreciate those police officers who put on that uniform every day. And I also understand and appreciate how you could be on your second shift and treat everything the same way as well. I absolutely do that. But the question I always pose is that why is it that, you know, given the diaspora of our country's, you know, diversity, why is it it's always African-Americans dying at the hands of police officers? You know, where's the Asian Americans? Where are Native Americans, Jewish Americans? We could go through every demographic. It seems like we're the ones that are always losing our life to encounters with the police. And again, I'll say this. Your question was, do I see the police in any different light? I will go out of my way not to involve the police is the easiest way for me to say that.
When you say, why is it always go back to the African-American population that gets brutalized by law enforcement, I think one of the reasons why there's such pushback from white America or red America, let's say, is because people don't want to view things in a larger framework. They don't want to put it in the 400-year context of slavery. It hurts their brain. Ignorance happens when people don't want to understand history and don't want to put things into a context that has perpetuated this inequality and brutality for the last four centuries. This didn't just come out of nowhere, and this isn't just a product of Donald Trump or cell phones.
I 100% agree about that. I think that we have a lot more access to this situation now than we have ever. We have the wherewithal to get it around the globe in seconds. Whereas, you know, if you think back to the Rodney King situation, it took some person having to videotape it, you know, then edit it and then get it to, you know, the news media and then have them run it on the news. You know, now all of that can be done, you know, with a simple touch of a button on your cell phone. And it really does give you an unfiltered look at what, like you said, to a person, no black person was surprised at what they saw. You know, what was really surprising, if I'm going to be honest, was the Amy Cooper incident in Central Park, which I think has a lot more relevance to what we're dealing with right now, if you ask me. Here's a situation where you have a woman who is in obvious violation of what was the set standards and rules of the park. And her recourse was to not admit her own guilt, but to incriminate the person who was simply recording this. And I think that mindset is one that is a scary one too. The emphasis on white privilege there, the I don't have to obey the law, but you do approach to life was really very startling. You would think that with a camera on your face that you would at least leash your dog right then, to have the dog jumping around and twisted around his collar to the point where you can see the dog is visibly gasping for its own air, and to have, again, her attention be on the fact that she's being violated just by being outed, to me, shows that that's something that I would never be able to experience. I'd never be in the midst of breaking a law and go, I'm threatening to call the police. That I think is one of the ironies to that situation, but it's no different to me than when you look at, you know, the college cheating scandal, where this woman who put hundreds of thousands of dollars into a scam to get two daughters into a prestigious university didn't serve 1 year of time, in fact, served 2 months. And you have that juxtaposed to a young lady who had her first grade child moved into her father's school district so he could attend a better school. And she served 5 years for that, you know? And so you look at that one disparity right there, right there. You would think that cheating into college would be more egregious than cheating into an elementary school. You could see that both parents wanted the best for their children at different stages of life. So I think that that is a stark sort of picture of the United States of America, that even when justice is meted out, it's meted out in a way where, you know, you don't feel like you need to adhere to anything when you're white. If I can't pay my way out of it, then I'll serve a little bit of time. Even if I serve a little bit of time, you know, if I'm Sheriff Joe Arpaio, you know, the president's going to pardon me. You know, even if I plead guilty, you know, the justice system is going to say, you know what, Michael Flynn, yeah, you know what, you're not guilty. I know you said you were. I know you lied. I know we convicted you. Now, think of that versus how long it took the Central Park Five to get their names expunged from what they hadn't done. And they never pled guilty.
May your hands always be busy. May your feet always be swift. May you have a strong foundation when the winds are changing shifts. May your heart always be joyful. May your song always be sung. And may you stay forever
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Maurice Plains. He is the Director of Scholars Advancement for Emerging Scholars. So, Maurice, we went to Phillips Academy Andover together, a elite private school in Massachusetts, and you work in emerging scholars. You're trying to get a lot of these children from middle and lower income families to get into some of these schools. Why don't you explain your road there and how it informs the work that you do?
All right. So I was very blessed. And that's why I said, in being completely honest, I wanted to get away from my mom. She was what I thought at the time was very overbearing and, you know, watched my steps and was very, put it this way, I was a very sheltered individual is the easiest way to say it. And even throughout that, I attended school in a magnet program in, you know, the projects, basically. So I would leave where I would normally go to school in my neighborhood and would travel two neighborhoods over so that I could attend school there with the guise of, you know, elevating the stats or the elevating the test scores of that school. In addition, they'll let you do 3 years of middle school in two. So I did sixth grade, seventh grade, and then ninth grade was the deal in that. In my ninth grade year, I applied to Phillips Academy Andover, as well as several other independent schools through an organization known as Better Chance or ABC. Shouts to ABC. They're still doing what they do. They still have a ABC house at Andover for students who will attend Andover High but will live in the Bronx and Brooklyn and Queens. And they have that still going on all around the country. So I'm very proud to be an ABC student. That's how I was introduced to this program. The ABC house, I don't know if you remember that when we were up at Andover, there were nine students that lived in that house who went and attended Andover High. and then would come back and live in the house. And then they'd go back on our schedule, you know, back to New York or to wherever where they lived for holidays. And that's, and ABC still does that to this day. The reason why ABC was so pertinent back then to us is that we were in the middle of the 80s, as you know. You know, crack was running rampant through many of the neighborhoods and was ravishing all parts of society. So, you know, being in middle school in the 80s in New York was no easy feat. So my mom wanted, you know, something better for me. I actually wanted something better for me, too, because my mom wouldn't let me out of the house because so much was going on outside of the door. When I found out that I could attend a school and live there, that's all she had to say to me. And next thing you know, that's where I'm at. And for what it's worth, I am very blessed to have attended that school. I wouldn't know people like you, Alex, or you know, people who are my close friends to this day, Milton Baez, Kendall Price, Ben Brooks, Tommy Takutis. I could go on.
So with the George Floyd killing in mind and these marches, do you think things are changing for the better now? Or do you think this is just, we're going to look back at this as another blip of anger?
Well, what I will tell you is that while I don't think the George Floyd incident is anything new, wasn't even new that week.
No, but the response to it.
The response was one where I think that if I were a business owner, a landlord, that kind of thing, you realize how the police have the job of keeping order, if you will. And once you can't trust in the police, you can't expect to see order. And that disorder and that disharmony is what you're seeing. And what I also think is new is that these protests have gone outside of the continental United States. There are other countries now who have our number, if you will. So we want to be sure that if this wasn't the tipping point here, the next time will certainly be the tipping point. And there will be no getting back, you know. Again, I still think that these officers still have to be tried and convicted because, that, as I said to Rodney King, that's still another one of those bubbles that are out there. All right. And same for the guys who did Ahmaud Arbery, right? These are trials that, you know, everybody's holding their breath about. And if the outcome is not what, you know, we've been protesting for, you should expect to see this even more so when that happens. And that's what scares me, too. So we want to make sure that we've taken it off the level of the police and now make it to the people who, you know, administrate or do the administration of justice, right? The prosecuting attorneys, the judges, the jurors, they should be well-informed and intelligent and approach this in a sense where they know that this is a groundbreaking case and that they need to be certain that they handle it with care.
Maurice Plains, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so very much, Alex Wise. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Tupac Shakur, Gil Scott-Heron, and Eddie Vedder.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.